This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. David Schindler has dedicated his life to understanding freshwater and the pollutants that harm it. Not only is he a professor emeritus of ecology in the Department of Biological Sciences at the University of Alberta, Edmonton, but he's also the founding director of the Experimental Lakes Area. It's a research facility in Ontario that explores changes and pollution impacts in entire ecosystems. Some of their most groundbreaking research found that phosphorus was having severe effects on freshwater. Schindler is visiting the area and meeting with students and faculty as part of UW-La Crosse's Distinguished Lectures in the Life Sciences series. David, you have quite the career. You've published hundreds and hundreds of research papers. You're a Rhodes Scholar. I'm sure you could probably go on forever of everything you've done. But can you just first start out by talking about how you decided that you wanted to spend your life examining ecology and biology and making that your passion?
I grew up in northwestern Minnesota, and lakes had always been a passion for me. I can remember talking to relatives, always trying to persuade someone to take me to the lakes when I was growing up. And that continued through high school. But when I got near finishing, I started looking for paths to university and careers, and I was told there were no careers in biology by my small high school counselors. So I went into engineering physics. And fortuitously, I was visiting a friend at another university and got into a conversation with one of the profs in biology who was looking for someone who could set up and run a bomb calorimeter to determine the energy contents of organisms. And when he found out that I had had a freshman physics lab on that very topic, he hired me for the summer to set up and run that. And in those days, machines didn't measure temperatures. Human eyes looking through a telescope at a thermometer did. And some of the readings were several minutes apart that I needed to do the mathematics to calculate the energy contents of these organisms. So in between, I would take things off his shelf and read them. And in the course of the summer, I read three or four books, most of them in ecology. And among them were Charles Elton's Ecology of Invasions by Plants and Animals and Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. And that fall, I changed universities and changed majors and never looked back.
And in your time growing up in the different lakes in northern Minnesota, did you ever notice changes within the lakes and within the waters?
I didn't. But this was almost in pre-cottage days. I can remember going out with my uncles, and we'd find a little farm somewhere. This was country occupied almost exclusively by Norwegians. And these farmers would have a little rowboat on the shore, and they'd let you use it for 50 cents a night usually, and we'd row out and fish. But it was not until the last few years that I was there that cottage development started. And it was that cottage development together with, in some of the cases of land use changes in the watershed, that started what became the nuisance that we know today, the problem that scientists call eutrophication, the accelerated nutrient inputs that cause blooms of algae.
A lot of your research has looked at eutrophication. So can you explain a little more to listeners what exactly is going on when this occurs in freshwater?
As we found out at the experimental lakes, it results almost exclusively from accelerated inputs of phosphorus, at least in fresh water, where the main nuisance blooms are the so-called blue-green algae or cyanobacteria that can fix atmospheric nitrogen. In some ecosystems, it's thought that nitrogen is also responsible, but because many of these species can fix nitrogen directly from the atmosphere, cyanobacterial blooms are largely driven by phosphorus.
And phosphorus is often found in household products and fertilizers?
They used to be found in household products. We found that two big sources in our research were household detergents and, of course, human sewage. And both of those reached lakes through so-called point sources, municipal sewage. And the result of our work was that controls on phosphorus were put on those sources. Fortunately, it's a simple element to remove, at least with about 95% efficiency. So legislation in both the U.S. and Canada started to remove phosphorus. However, it also comes from feedlots, cottage developments via land runoff and via septic tank runoff and via land erosion. So because no attention was paid to those, despite the warnings of some of us that we had really only solved half the problem, as land use and fertilizer applications and urbanization have intensified, we're getting the problem back. So, for example, after the legislation that I mentioned, Lake Erie and Lake Ontario recovered almost completely for about 20 years, and then they started to reverse. And they're in a situation right now where they're in almost as bad a shape as they were in the late 60s and early 70s, except that now we have sources that, because they're not discrete, are much more difficult to control.
So why is it that phosphorus is showing up again, or the eutrophication is becoming problematic in some of these bodies of water once again?
Many of the watersheds have high phosphate soils. So if you remove the vegetation and plow it up or something like that, expose bare soil to the rain and snow, you get more phosphorus running off from those. And then again, it's applied as fertilizer, especially in areas where manure is applied. Manure has a very high phosphorus content, almost the same as human sewage, typically about 2-to-1 nitrogen to phosphorus on a weight basis. And because algae are almost always phosphorus limited when in a natural state, and they require only one phosphorus per 7 or 8 nitrogens, there's phosphorus in excess, and these forms that can get their nitrogen and carbon from the atmosphere tend to thrive in that kind of environment, outcompeting all of the species that would require more nitrogen. So unfortunately, the very species we don't want are the ones that are favored by these high phosphorus runoffs. In addition to that, it's been discovered recently that these are also the species that produce toxins that were first thought only to affect livestock and pets, and now there's accumulating evidence that they may be associated with human health problems as a result of drinking the water or even swimming in it. So suddenly we're faced with a major water quality problem once again. Even though we know how to cure it, we've let the horse out of the barn, so to speak, and it's going to be very difficult to get it back in.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCullum. My guest today is David Schindler. He's a professor emeritus of ecology in the Department of Biological Sciences at the University of Alberta, Edmonton, and he's the founding director of the Experimental Lakes area in Ontario. He's visiting the area as part of UW-La Crosse's Distinguished Lectures in the Life Sciences series. You talked about a lot of the major research that has been done over the last few decades regarding phosphorus and freshwater. And most of this research started at the Experimental Lakes area. Can you talk about the history of that project itself? Because that itself was very groundbreaking when it began.
in the mid-1960s, the Canadian government had a research arm known as the Fisheries Research Board of Canada, which was a group of independent senior scientists who were handed money by the government to do independent research to underpin policies in fisheries and water management. And they deduced, as the result of what was happening in the Great Lakes and analogous big lakes in Europe, that algal blooms were a major problem. In those days, it wasn't known how to control or reverse the problem. And after a couple of years of frustrating attempts to get policymakers to react to experiments done in little bottles, our then director proposed that some experiments be done in whole lakes. And I liked the idea of whole lakes in the wilderness as a place to work. It fit with my chosen lifestyle otherwise, so I was hired to find a suitable lake area, a site for a laboratory, get a road built to the laboratory, select about 50 lakes that they could negotiate control of, and propose some first experiments to solve the eutrophication problem. At least that was the one-page letter that outlined my duties for the first year.
Was it ever controversial at that time to take these pristine lakes and to purposefully experiment on them and pollute them in some senses?
It was. Actually, there was some very badly mangled press that went out from the government on this, and local people got very upset because what was put out was so vague that they thought we were going to be toxifying the lakes and that these were going to include Lake of the Woods and other huge lakes in the area, whereas all of our experiments in that early stage were to stimulate the fauna and flora of lakes, and they were all in lakes under 10 hectares in size, virtual ponds. So it took 4 or 5 years to overcome that local suspicion of what we were doing. Some actually thought we were setting up a private fishing preserve for politicians. But we started working with the public in that area, running tours for schools and things. And over the years, first that suspicion melted away, and then many of the locals got jobs there. Many of the local businesses started to depend on business from the Experimental Lakes area, to where in the past year, when the government proposed to shut it down, there were petitions signed by all of the mayors in northwestern Ontario and protests held in front of the Minister of Parliament for that area in Kenora's riding, protesting the proposed closure of the Experimental Lakes area. And it was amazing. The polls that were done showed that ELA had about a 75% public recognition about Canada, which is right up there with Wayne Gretzky, and that even the most conservative of voters were opposed to the government's plan to close the station.
Where does it stand now?
It's in limbo right now. After the government saw how unpopular they were getting, they quickly changed their story that they were not really trying to close it. It's just that they had no need for it anymore. They claimed that they could do equivalent research in other areas, which is complete nonsense. There are no other areas in Canada or anywhere else where you have a license to do controlled experiments in whole lakes. And then they claimed that they would try and find a new organization to support it. They found that organization in the International Institute for Sustainable Development, who agreed to take it over if the right conditions could be met. And that was followed by the provinces of Ontario first, followed by Manitoba, saying that they would put up money to support the transfer. So while negotiations are still ongoing and it looks optimistic, there's still a few major hurdles. Like the reason that we could add pollutants to those lakes is that there was an agreement between the province of Ontario and the federal government that the province would allow that. The Constitution gives the province's control over lakes within provincial boundaries, and the amounts we were adding were small, and part of the agreement was that we would recover the lakes, and there hasn't been a case so far that the lakes have not been recovered. But since the federal government wants to pull out, some analogous agreement is now necessary with either the International Institute for Sustainable Development or in some other form, such as a specific law waiving the normal regulations that are applied to industry for experimental lakes. It's kind of an absurd situation because most provinces can write waivers for major industries that are putting tons of pollutants into lakes, and yet here the experimental lakes, which wants to put a few grams in typically, is caught up in these regulations. So it's something that should clearly be solvable by government. So I'm hoping it's just a matter of a few months and they'll have that detail figured out.
And we know that there has been a lot of important research that's come out of the experimental lakes area. You touched on the phosphorus and the algal blooms, and I'm sure that's only just scratching the surface is what's gone on there. And you mentioned how there's even more that can be done. So what kind of research had been going on or is going on at the experimental lakes now? And when you look in the future, what more can be determined from those waters?
Okay, well, looking back, the second problem we tackled was acid rain, and we showed that lakes began to deteriorate at an acidity tenfold less acidic than people had thought, mainly because some of the lower organisms in food chains are more sensitive than sport fish. So we found that conditions could develop where sport fish would actually starve. While the acids were not toxic directly to them, the fact that organisms that they relied on were meant that they starved. That resulted in tougher regulations for acidifying emissions of sulfur oxides, for example, than would have happened otherwise. After that, we did experiments with reservoirs, which undercut the thought that most politicians had that reservoirs were good, clean power by showing that they had considerable greenhouse gas emissions, but that they could be designed in a way that they would emit less than a quarter of the greenhouse gas emissions as generating the same sort of power by burning coal or fossil fuels. And after that, there was an experiment with the hormone in birth control pills at realistic concentrations that showed that fish were feminized. The males were feminized. As a result, the population quit reproducing, and the fish quickly died away. That experiment should have resulted in more experiments, including ways to control the results of those things, but it was a time of government cutbacks, and it didn't. That's one thing that needs to be picked back up in the future. The most recent work that's really important is a joint U.S.-Canada experiment on mercury, where not just straight elemental mercury, but three different stable isotopes of mercury are added to a lake and the uplands in its watershed and the wetlands in its watershed. And they're tracked into fish and other members of the food chain. And contrary to what was thought at the time the experiment started, was found that lakes react very quickly with more mercury being added within months to the whole food chain, but that they react equally quickly when you remove the sources of that mercury. So implicating that if we cut off coal burning, for example, or mercury from coal burning. The many fish consumption advisories that we have in the U.S. and Canada should slowly or rapidly decline away. Hopefully, it would save many dollars and many fisheries for indigenous people. One that didn't get off the ground, but we're hoping for next spring, is one that Trent University is taking the lead on. It's to look at the effects of nanoparticles of silver on communities. Now, that might sound exotic to most people, but in fact, most of us are sitting around today with nano silver in our socks and underwear.
Really? And I was going to guess cell phones, maybe.
Possibly there, too. I don't know the details that much, but I know that it's a common thing that's woven into garment fibers because it's antibacterial. So if your socks or your underwear don't seem to smell as bad as they used to after a couple of days of wear, that may be why.
And you want to see the effects that that could be having on?
Well, silver is known to be a very toxic element. It's the effluent from silver mines, for example, is often very, very toxic to aquatic life. And nanoparticles, which are so small that they can move right through membranes and that, seem to be a potential vector that could carry this toxin right into the tissues of organisms. So the plan is to do a detailed test of that in an isolated small lake. And if it is shown to damage organisms, probably we'll have some changes in regulations, as we've seen for phosphates and precursors of acid rain. But the experiment was delayed a year by this breakdown of the federal agreement to run ELA.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guest today is David Schindler. He's a professor emeritus of ecology in the Department of Biological Sciences at the University of Alberta, Edmonton, and he's the founding director of the Experimental Lakes Area. He's visiting the La Crosse area as part of UWL's Distinguished Lectures in the Life Sciences series. You mentioned before how politics gets in the way of science. Have there been points in your career where politics has really gotten in the way of the research that you're doing?
There have, and there's also been points where it was wonderful to work with politicians, the best case being the phosphates and detergents. We actually had politicians and regulators visiting the site and phoning to ask when we were going to have information available that would give them a clear basis for the policies that were needed. Unfortunately, we seem to have gotten worse at times. And now the worry of many politicians is not whether they can protect the environment. It's whether they can protect the economy. And it's rather strange. Economies like some sort of mysterious Inca god instead of a few nubile virgins that you throw on the altar and stab to try to pacify the great God economy. You throw a few ecosystems, but it's the same idea, and there's about as much forethought behind it. So we're doing some strange things in the nature of protecting the economy that, looking ahead, might protect it for a few years, but down the road, it's a recipe for disaster. And I would recommend that anybody under the age of 40 take a hard look at what governments are doing. There are things being done now that are going to affect how you and your children and grandchildren are going to live.
I think I read somewhere that you wrote that often politicians get in the way of science and they expect science to conform to what they want and need.
Yes, that's very much the case. To have science underpin sound policy to protect the environment makes sense, but to have to expect policy to inform science, and science to conform to what they do is almost like happened in the Soviet Union and to physics in the U.S. in the McCarthy era. It's sort of like the logic is similar to controlling lung cancer, expecting that to produce cigarettes. There is so little causal information there that it makes no sense at all scientifically.
Maybe global warming could be the poster child example of the intersection of science and politics. But do you think that there are other major issues that we as people or maybe as researchers aren't moving forward on as much as they should be because politics is getting in the way?
That's been the history of many of the industrial activities since I started, going right back to phosphorus in the late 1960s and early 70s. Industries can assemble a few scientists, usually, who'll support their point of view. You know, science always has a few doubters, and you know, climate has a few doubters too, even though they're about less than 3%, and most of them are not very well informed. But casting doubt usually gives industry a few years. You can see that in spades in big tobacco. You know, correspondence is coming out now showing that the tobacco industry recognized that they had a problem 50 years ago, but through these so-called merchants of doubt who took money from them to cast doubt that we knew the things that needed to be controlled, they continued for a few decades making billions of dollars. And now we can see that same sort of evidence from fossil fuel producers by delaying legislation to control climate warming makes one feel rather badly, because the evidence has been there, not about the magnitude of warming, but I first saw the evidence that indicated that there would be an accelerated CO2 buildup in the atmosphere in oceanographic data from the 1960s and even the late 50s, determined by geochemists who were able to show that all of the CO2 in the atmosphere was not going to be quickly absorbed by the oceans, as had been thought prior to that. In fact, only was thought then perhaps two-thirds would be and the rest would accumulate. That hasn't been a bad number, even though we have much more science and much more sophisticated science. So it's rather strange, after half a century, see people still claiming that there's a controversy and still see people suspicious of this data set and the science that produces it. And these theories that there's 3,000 scientists in some sort of a conspiracy to get money to further their careers. I think some of those people would find it an eye-opener to go to a scientific meeting where they watch these people interact. There are groups that are intensely competitive, and rather than cooperating, it's about like watching cooperation between bobcats that you throw into a burlap bag and close it up and beat it with a stick. It's any consensus that you get in the scientific community is very hard won, and we have a consensus.
David Schindler is a professor emeritus of ecology in the Department of Biological Sciences at the University of Alberta, Edmonton, and is founding director of the Experimental Lakes area. He was visiting the region as part of UW-La Crosse's Distinguished Lectures in the Life Sciences series. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Coming up next, we'll talk with a University of Minnesota anthropologist about what life was like in the Upper Mississippi River Valley when the first Native Americans inhabited the area 13,000 years ago. Archives of this and other recent editions of Newsmakers, extended interviews, photos, and a link to the Experimental Lakes area can be found on our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. You can also like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. It won't ever be considered the cradle of civilization, but there's still a rich history of people who inhabited the Upper Mississippi River region thousands of years ago. Dr. Guy Gibbon is a professor emeritus of anthropology at the University of Minnesota, who wrote a book that examines that history, titled Archaeology of Minnesota. The Milwaukee native spoke earlier this fall at UW-La Crosse, and Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis had a chance to interview him about his work, which includes one of the first archaeological digs at the Midway site in Onalaska in the mid-1960s.
I received my master's and PhD degrees from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where I worked on Wisconsin archaeological sites. I did my master's on a site in Onalaska, just north of here. I've had very close connections over the years with the people at MVAC, many of whom are now retiring. I taught one year at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and I thought I'd be doing Wisconsin archaeology my whole life, and somehow I ended up at Minnesota. And I've been up there since 1973. I've written a bunch of books, mainly, and this is interesting, if you get your career in a research institution, your career takes a different direction. And I keep thinking if I had been at Milwaukee, my career would have been different, you know. Mm-hmm. In Minnesota, you wrote lots of books, and that's what I did. Mm-hmm. So I've been retired about 2 years.
Talk a little bit about your experience getting your master's degree in Onalaska. What was that archaeological dig all about?
I had been an undergraduate for 2 years at Madison, so I had worked in the archaeology lab. And as I was starting my master's program, my advisor, Dr. David Barris, you know, had some questions at the time that was thought that the Oneota appeared during what's called the Little Ice Age. You know, things are getting colder, and he had a dispute with another archaeologist about how big sites were. Did people fragment into little groups, etc.? And so he called me into his office and said, "I want you to get a car and some students and go out and, you know, look at the site." And in those days, you know, La Crosse was, you know, like Siberia, because, you know, none of the big freeways were there at the time. Mm. And it was a wonderful experience. We excavated in the fall. We excavated in the site called the Midway Site in Onalaska. And what was, in retrospect, a lot of that site's been destroyed, I believe, for a quarry. You know, so it was just kind of happenstance that we happened to work in that site before it was destroyed. And I wrote a big report on it and, learned a lot about Oneota. And in those days, there was no MVAC. People didn't realize, the superabundance of sites. The La Crosse area, it's part of what's called the Gorge of the Upper Mississippi. You know, we've learned over the time with Jim Gallagher's work and Connie and other people that just one of the downsides, if I can say that a little bit, is just like the Native Americans, you know, love the area, et cetera, and made their villages in certain places, of course, you know, our ancestors like the same places. And so a lot of these sites are under streets. And, you know, Kathy Stevenson right now is working up in Onalaska, you know, in an urban setting. But it was a wonderful setting way back when, and it still is. One thing about working in Oneota sites is that you retrieve large amounts of material. And there are lots of what we call features, like storage pits underground and house foundations and things. And after I had worked on Oneota up in Onalaska, I said, well, why wasn't I smart enough to pick an earlier culture like what we call the Archaic, where maybe I'd find 3 projectile points and 7 chips and I could write a whole master's thesis on it. And on the other hand, the real abundance of material in these sites can really tell you a lot about people's lifeways. And, this was a time when people were, living in areas. Earlier on, for thousands of years, people lived in very small groups and were fairly mobile. And so their archaeological remains are, most cases, practically invisible. You know, you just can't find them. In southern Minnesota, particularly southwestern Minnesota, there was so much buildup of soil that the site's maybe 10 feet underground or more. You know what I mean? So these sites we're talking about now date from, let's say, 1300 to historic contact, you know, 1650 or 1700 in this area. And so they're near the surface, lots of material, lots of bone. So we can really learn a lot. And, of course, I spent lots and lots and lots of time in the lab, you know, working on this material. Part of the argument that I went to kind of resolve was, were these kind of larger sites or were they just repeated occupation by a family or two? And, you know, this was a fairly large site, and, you know, we excavated in different parts of the site. And basically what we found was that the stone material and everything was pretty similar. And so we concluded that this was probably a larger site.
Talk a little bit about the first people who inhabited Minnesota.
Let me start by saying that there are various ways to date the earliest people, and that's important. And we use a radiocarbon dating technique primarily. And the problem with radiocarbon dating is the older the dates get, the more error there is with true calendar dates, okay? Mm-hmm. And so one thing I do in my book is there's something called calibration where you make that adjustment to calendar dates. And they used to say that, well, people peered in Minnesota maybe at 11,000 B.C., something like that. And now we say that they lived in the state about 13,000 years. So, mm-hmm. so the one thing is that they probably came in much earlier. And as far as we can tell, the that there are very small numbers of people, and that they primarily were trying to encounter game. They lived off of game in our area. About all we can see is some of their projectile points. And I call these people in the book a pioneer foragers. You know, they're the very first people to enter this area. And, you know, people forget, you know, how big a state like Minnesota is. We're so used to how big the United States is. And I tell my students that Minnesota is just about as big as England, Scotland, and Wales put together. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So you look at a world map and you look at that and you get an idea of how big this is. So you have this big area. You have a very few number of archaeologists. You know what I mean? And so my feeling is, to answer your question, is that these were, you know, pioneer foragers who entered. We don't know if they were snowbirds who wintered in La Crosse, maybe, and then moved north. The other thing I think is important is, you know, people, when they look for archaeological remains, they look at the present environment, and they say, well, if I was going to camp or if I was going to hunt, I'd go here. And we have to remember that we're talking about an ice age environment. I mean, people entered Wisconsin and Minnesota at the end of the ice age. You know what I mean? And so there are still glaciers in the north. The whole forest were quite different. They were closed spruce forests, which is kind of a boreal forest, except it's further south. It didn't have the abundance, basically, of food resources that you find in La Crosse area today, for example, you know.
We're seeing inhabitants about the time that the ice age is coming to an end.
Yeah, I would say basically that people are here maybe 1,000 years before the. It's a little misleading to talk about the end of the ice age,
right?
Because it was more of a process. You know, it ended earlier in some areas, and the further north you go, it went on and on and on. Okay.
How do you define the people who inhabited Minnesota for those first 12,500 years?
One problem, obvious problem we have is to say, who were they? You know what I mean? Were they? If you look at early historic Minnesota, you know, if you look at historic Minnesota, basically the Ojibwe, or what we call Anishinaabe, you know, entered during the historic period. And before that, you know, it was mainly Dakota, Lakota people in the Northwoods. And then to the south, there were people who became Iowa and perhaps Odo. So these were all Siouan-speaking peoples. And the question is, well, how far back does that go? You know what I mean? Because when you work with Native people, you know, they want to know. You know, where did they come from? What were their sites? Things like this. And so the best thing is to say that a lot of these early people are Native Americans for sure, though some people claim we have a Scandinavian or two running around the state. Mm-hmm. And there basically we don't know who they were, you know. What I can say is a little bit about their changing life way, if I can, because we think basically for the first, over 8,000 years, these were very small family groups, who were moving across the landscape in the interior looking for game. What happened through time is a population slowly grew. And it was no longer possible just to roam anywhere because that was somebody else's area. And as population grew, people found that they couldn't live just by a focus on hunting. And so they started to diversify. I want to say 4,000 years ago, they started to diversify and they started to use more wild rice and fish and small animals and things like this. And this is when the archaeological sites that we see prominently began to be formed. Because they were living more permanently around lakes and rivers. But that earlier kind of roaming life way, basically, as I say, lasted for over 8,000 years. It was very interesting.
How do things like the weather and climate and the natural resources help shape civilization in the state of Minnesota?
See, that's a good question. And that's at the very basis of what I call a life way approach. Because, and if you read a book about North American archaeology, they have various kinds of phases. They talk about something like the Archaic, and there's a date when it ended, and they talk about the woodland, there's a date when it ended, and things like this. And really, if you take a state as big as Wisconsin or as big as Minnesota, with such a varied environment, Minnesota has a prairie off in the west, it's drier in the west. You go way up north, and you're almost in boreal forest. Things like this. We can't just say that all these people had the same life way because they were basically responding to the local resources that they could, have access to. And so you're not going to expect, for example, a life way in southern Wisconsin to be the same as something in Alabama. Or Louisiana, where they have a 12-month growing season. Mm-hmm. And up here, you have a 6 or 7 month growing season. And so lifeway approach is really, firmly based in, understanding the local climate, understanding the local animals and plants, things like this. In a state like Minnesota, which I wrote a book about, so I say more about it, is that we see that these changes I've been talking about towards intensification, having different kind of camps and things like this, that these things appear at quite different times in different parts of the state. For example, central Minnesota, which is the lower zone of what we call the North Woods, was by far the most intensely occupied part of Minnesota. Southern Minnesota, had some people, but not many. Mm-hmm. And so we see all of this intensification in places like the Headwaters area up in Minnesota much earlier. Just to emphasize these differences, I had a four kind of period development of these phases of lifeways, and the fourth one is called a tribal lifeway, where people are living in bigger villages and things like this, and that doesn't appear in Minnesota until after 1,000 years ago. And I think tribes appeared in places like Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi in the late Archaic. So I'm talking about 4,000 or 5,000 years ago.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis. We're talking about the archaeology of the Upper Mississippi River region with Dr. Guy Gibbon. He's a professor emeritus of anthropology at the University of Minnesota and the author of several books, including The Archaeology of Minnesota. We've been talking a lot about thousands of years ago, but just for a reference, when did the first European settlers land in the state of Minnesota?
Well, there's a difference between settlers and contact. Okay. Because, of course, about 1650, we have people like Duluth and Radisson and people like this who basically are coming across Lake Superior, and making some contact, but really not having. Father Hennepin, for example, and I forget the exact date, but let's say 1680, supposedly was captured along the Mississippi River, not far from here, and actually taken up to Lake Mille Lacs in central Minnesota, and then supposedly kept capture there. But we're not sure because these people all wanted to write great best-selling books, and so they tended to romanticize what actually happened. And then after that, we have a long period of French and then English fur traders. The first American settlement in Minnesota was a military one. And this was what's called Fort Snelling at the juncture of the Mississippi and Minnesota rivers. And then there were a series of treaties. The first one was about 1837. If I remember, there was another one maybe at 1857 that started to open the state up, and that's when the settlers came in.
The book defines southeastern Minnesota as a region.
Yep, that's right.
How was that different back then?
Of course, there's a best-selling book by MVAC, by Ernie Bossart and Jim Thieler, you know, on the archaeology of this region, the upper Mississippi River Valley. And one thing they say in the book is, you know, that the archaeology north of La Crosse is practically unknown. And, of course, you know, that enters into southeastern Minnesota. And so when I wrote that section of the book, and, of course, if you look at the archaeological culture, you know, the pottery and things like this, it's that part of Minnesota that's most similar, you know, to the area south of La Crosse. And if you go to southwestern Minnesota or northern central Minnesota, you find that it's so different, you know, that we can't compare it. So what I did in the book, and there are very scant remains in southeastern Minnesota. I mean, just a few sites compared to what you find in Prairie du Chien and areas south of La Crosse. To me, it's been a kind of a puzzle. It wasn't until about 1,000 years ago when these tribal groups came that you started to find substantial settlements in southeastern Minnesota.
You mentioned the size of the state of Minnesota. What type of research and archaeological digs are you basing this on? Is there a good percentage of the state of Minnesota that's been explored by archaeologists?
Basically, when you have cultural resource management archaeology, that is responding to state and federal legislation, you know, you go where there's a problem, right? Mm-hmm. Once that kind of state and federal mandated archaeology started, people are looking at in areas of Minnesota that the professional academic archaeologists didn't look at. You know, we went to the best places, if I can say that, Mille Lac, the Headwaters Lakes, Rainy River. And so I would say that more areas of Minnesota have been explored in the last 20 years than the earlier 50. There's a downside to all this, however, and that is that it's not the job of a cultural resource management archaeologist to actually write a history of Minnesota archaeology. You know, they write a report for the contractor, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so there are lots and lots of reports on this, and in many cases it's difficult to synthesize just because it's all over the place.
You've kind of touched on this, but the archaeology of this part of the state, the state of Wisconsin, I should say, is very similar to southeastern Minnesota.
In the book, I made it seem so. So there's kind of a difference, you know. If I look at the scant remains in southeastern Minnesota, they most resemble, you know, what we find down here. And so what I did was, when I described the various periods, I looked at the work that MVAC people have done, you know, and I borrowed a lot of their ideas. And I say that repeatedly throughout the book, you know, that this is probably what it was like. You know what I mean? And it's still a puzzle to me why we don't find a greater numbers of people in southeastern Minnesota than you find south of La Crosse. So, you know, it gives us something to think about.
How does what we've learned about the archaeology of Minnesota relate to today's Minnesota?
A lot of our graduate students in our program up at University of Minnesota, you know, study contemporary Native American groups, you know, such as the Ojibwe or Lakota groups and things like this. This isn't answering your question specifically, but really one of the things that is interesting is how Native American groups are trying to preserve their traditional life ways in a commercial present-day Minnesota or Wisconsin. You know what I mean? So that's very important. We can look at the past, and I can look at their life ways, and then I can say, well, how are they trying to survive? Some of them, are doing quite well. Particularly with casinos in the southern part of the state. But Ojibwe groups up at White Earth and places like that and kind of north-central Minnesota that are trying to remain what are called subsistence people where they're not farmers and things like this. So I'm not answering your question exactly. The other thing, of course, is the natural environment. You know, one thing we can see is how the impact of settlers and that has really changed the environment.
Dr. Guy Gibbon is a professor emeritus of anthropology at the University of Minnesota. He was at UW-La Crosse earlier this fall. He was interviewed by Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis about his book, Archaeology of Minnesota, tracing the history of people who lived in the state some 13,000 years ago. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCullum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior producer, John Davis. To hear archives of this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find extended interviews and photos. And if you'd like to comment on our program, or if you have a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. You can also find Newsmakers on Facebook, updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more. Like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.